Okay, here we go, hour number two, and we're going to change gears, as we like to do often throughout these 3 hours. We're going to go take a look at the latest, what a spectacle, the Great Pyramid, the Monuments of Giza. Christopher Dunn is back with us tonight. We had Howard Middleton Jones on a couple of weeks ago, and Chris heard that Howard was on, and we've had Chris on. He's been a friend of this program for I don't know how long now, long, long time, but if anyone knows more about the great monuments at Giza than Chris Dunn, I'd like to know who it is. He is an engineer, a man who understands the technical expertise required to create large monolithic blocks and other things that are involved with the enormity of what we see in Giza. It's Chris Dunn. There's no one else. He's in a class by himself. Welcome back, Chris. It's great to talk to you. When was the first time you were on this program? Do you remember? How long ago was that?
Oh, gosh. I think it was... thank you for the introduction, Jeff, by the way. And hi.
You're welcome.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
I think the first time was probably around 1999, 2000.
Right. It's going on 20 years. Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost 20 years ago, and several discussions that we've had in the past about the Great Pyramid, and it was shortly after my first book was published, The Giza Power Plant, and I know that you had a fascination, and you were a great supporter of that work, and I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I still have the book, of course, and you bet. Now, Chris has an unusual background. He's not an archaeologist by training. Tell us about the background, Chris, because a lot of people don't know how really talented and capable and brilliant you are in this whole field of understanding things by measuring and looking at them in ways that I think archaeologists in many cases wouldn't do.
Well, I think from a from a technical perspective, my background is similar to many other people on the planet who become craftsmen. My path started as an apprentice in Manchester, England, and emigrating to America, I received several promotions and eventually ended up in management. But it involved going through engineer, being a tool and die maker, running a laser job shop in Indianapolis, which was a very unique experience for me, very stimulating.
Right.
Well, that was back in 1983.
Uh-huh.
And then working in engineering and then going into management. So it's a varied background, and each of the areas of manufacturing that I worked in provided me the opportunity to learn skills and gain knowledge that I've been able to apply in my pyramid research, which started in 1977.
Right.
So yeah, that's. So it's a for somebody who is researching and writing about the pyramids back in the 70s and the 80s, it is definitely a unique background. Today, I think there's a lot of people of similar backgrounds who are now getting into studying the Great Pyramid. And I've received a lot of communication with different individuals, engineers, craftspeople who may have read my work and find some value in it. And
well, they look to you in so many ways, Chris, because you really set the whole tone with your work. And we're going to look at some pictures tonight. And
I know you wanted to talk a little bit about the Great Pyramid, and the images that I forwarded to you are actually related to pyramid building and bring the effort to the enormous task of actually building pyramids into a clearer perspective. And brings it within the possibilities of actually you know, making it reasonable to do the work. But the first thing I think that you wanted to talk about was the void in the Great Pyramid. I know you addressed that with Howard.
Right,
that's the new
discovery of the space within the pyramid and there may be others, but this is one that has been confirmed by technical expertise and science itself. So tell us more.
Well, I mean, it's a fascinating discovery, and the methods that they used, the muonography, where, you know, they were actually detecting the muons that were impacting a target in the horizontal passage and in the downward shaft and in the Queen's Chamber to see if there were additional spaces within the pyramid. So what they determined was that there was a space above the Grand Gallery and one day the original entrance on the north side of the pyramid. Well, the one thing, you know, many people have asked me, well, what is my take on it? And when I saw the images, I saw it was more like a point cloud. In other words, if you take today we make point clouds if we're doing 3D scanning of objects. And
What's a point cloud, Chris? What's a point cloud?
It is a representation of an object or a surface, a three-dimensional surface, but essentially each point that is held in a computer's memory is held in a three-dimensional space, a theoretical three-dimensional space. So you have an X, Y, Z coordinate of that single point. And so all around the object, you have millions, sometimes millions of these points.
I got you.
That are held in the computer's memory. Mm-hmm. And then from those geometric points around the surface, they can determine the shape of it, the geometry of it. It's used actually for gaining information, gathering data from the manufacturing process sometimes, where a camera will capture an image, a three-dimensional image of an object, and then compare it to a master in the computer to see if it complies with the specifications. So it's, yeah, I mean, that technology is real. And so when we look at the what is presented to us from the Great Pyramid, it has the appearance of a point cloud, but from what has been transmitted, it does not seem to have any geometric form to it, except that it's kind of it's supposedly 100 feet long. Looks like it may be, or 10 feet high, 8 to 10 feet high, or something like that. And we don't know if it's on an angle or if it's horizontal, so that is still a question. There's a lot of questions. The questions that I have about it are, it seems to me that the resolution is not, is very rough. In other words, if you're looking at the object itself and you want to take a very precise picture of it, you have a very high resolution image of it, so that the surfaces that you are looking at are held within a certain tolerance band. And it's hard to imagine that muons that are traveling through the pyramid from outer space, from within the atmosphere, they're all actually traveling exactly in the same direction, and they follow a coherent path completely through the pyramid. It seems to me that some would come in on a slight angle, and so when they pass through that void, that space, they may not all follow the same line when they hit the target, and so the resolution is off. The dimensions could be off. Now, I'm not saying that they have not allowed for that and have some kind of method to actually understand or know exactly what the angle of incidence is when a muon hits their target, but that is a question that I have in my mind, just because of the appearance of the point cloud that they have.
Got it.
But it's
got
an interesting find, and it could potentially be very significant for the Giza power plant theory, but until we know more, it's hard to say. There's much more that needs to be found out.
Right. For our listeners, Chris's book, The Giza Power Plant, put forth the thesis and just a tremendous argument that the Great Pyramid is, or was, some kind of a machine, a functioning device that perhaps energy in, but certainly energy out of some kind. And we don't know how it worked, but Chris has a greater sense of this than anyone. He was the man who opened that door. Now, we have a lot of pictures below Chris's name and guests, so please load that page. And I can just tell by a quick scan, this is going to be fascinating, again, as always. Have you changed in any way your thoughts or your view, your analysis that the pyramid was a machine of some kind?
You know, of course, my thinking and my experience has been enriched over the years, I think. As far as a drastic change in direction, there's been some minor tweaks, such as when they did the exploration behind the southern shaft, the Gantenbrinks door, and they were able to photograph those closed loops that came through the limestone and back into the door itself, and so that was a modification to the theory, but generally it enhanced the theory and it confirmed it more than it caused me to say, I must be on the wrong track.
Right.
And there's been a lot of other things that have cropped up over the years too, and so that generally, I mean, when I set out to write the book, it was my objective to try and find an answer for every feature within the pyramid, because any theory that purports to explain the true purpose of the pyramid has to explain every single feature. And so the Giza power plant actually encompasses everything that you see now within within the pyramid, and then proposes what would have been there in order to make the machine functional.
Got it.
It's kind of like a reverse engineering project, or, you know, say if you didn't know, had no knowledge of what an internal combustion engine is, and so you were trying to find out what this lump of iron that you found in the jungle that didn't have any pistons in it or a camshaft or anything like that. And you've got a few things that you have to replace in order to for it to function. So that's basically a short answer to your question is the Giza power plant is still going strong, and I have, you know, I mean, the feedback that I've received has been very positive, particularly from engineers. There are current engineers now today who are actually carrying the work forward. So I'm very
exciting.
Very happy about that.
Yeah, that's very, very nice to hear. The back to the newly discovered cavity chamber inside. What is your latest understanding of what that might be size-wise, and do you see any others hidden away in that massive structure in the future that we may find?
Yes, I think there is going to be. I think there is access to the at least the end of the southern shaft, in that the electrodes that poke through that limestone block would need to be replaced periodically. And so there would have to be some maintenance. It would be quite a while to do it, but between maintenance cycles. But eventually, they would erode away, and they would need to be replaced. Now, interestingly enough, the images that were captured when the cameras were went through that the hole into that space, they show these markings on the floor of the shaft, and that people were very puzzled about what they represented because they weren't hieroglyphs or anything known about that. And so, but they were looked like they were electrical symbols, and so they were instructions on how to wire the electrodes in the door.
Now, when Chris talks about a door, we're talking about a very small door.
Yes, it's I mean that's the term that it was described as a door, but it's not really a door. Even Gantenbrink, that discovered it with his robot Upwat in 1993, he calls it a USO, short for unidentified stone object. But it's not a door. I mean, the shaft is only about 8 inches square. So,
but that required, you think, maintenance with those two? We'll call them electrodes.
Yes. And the evidence for that is actually can be seen on the electrodes when they were originally found, where you could see that they were highly eroded, and then there was some erosion around one of the electrodes, and then behind, when they were able to photograph behind the so-called door, one of the electrodes had a lot of sediment and erosion around it, which it just looked like a terminal on a car battery.
Yeah, fascinating. All right, let's do one more thing, and then we'll go to the pictures. The prevailing Zahi Hawass timeline of the Great Pyramid puts it at about what age? What's the current?
Well, I think the conventional theory is that it was 2500 BC, so that's generally they place the date of the pyramid.
4,500 years old, okay.
Yeah, 4,500 years.
But in reality, what's your best projection?
Well, I think there seems to be evidence that a lot of the monuments that you find in Egypt have been adopted and personalized with later cultures, and that's not surprising. But it makes sense to me that because of the destruction in Egypt of the pyramids, and that there was obviously a terrific cataclysm that happened, and now they're finding evidence of a comet strike around 9,000 BC or something like that, and so when we put those two together, then we have all the elements necessary to explain what happened to that civilization, and also what happened inside the Great Pyramid. Because as you recall, in the Giza power plant, I proposed that the central chamber, the power center, which is known as the King's Chamber, was disturbed in history at one time, and the walls were caused to expand outwards, and the blocks of granite that made up the ceiling of the chamber were cracked down the southern end. And so if you look at that and then consider that hydrogen was a gas that was being used to create microwaves in the process that was involved in the Great Pyramid, then you can see where an event like a comet strike would cause too much energy to impact the planet, and the pyramids being so finely tuned to the Earth energy, because that's where they were getting their energy. It was mechanical energy that they were passing through the pyramids, an input of a sudden huge input of energy would cause the pyramids to shake apart.
Yeah, it overdrove them completely.
It overdrove them. They became what is technically known as a runaway vibrator, where, you know, the vibrating object is fed more energy than it can handle, and it will just destroy itself.
That may have cracked the limestone casing. It might have fallen off in pieces. We don't know. But
right, and then you see, you go to places like Abu Ghraib, and you see where there are multi-ton blocks that look like they've just been thrown out of position, certainly not carried or moved. And then in other places like Meidum, where the whole facing stones of the pyramid would just fell and lie in a rubble around that pyramid.
Are we suggesting
a lot of destruction?
Chris, are we suggesting that this comet or meteorite strike hit the plateau near the pyramids?
Well, it wouldn't have to hit near the pyramid. I mean, there is evidence of a comet strike in southern Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere on the planet, if you have a massive force that strikes the planet, it's going to travel. That energy is going to travel around the Earth's plate, and it will affect the whole planet.
Wow. One can only imagine what this civilization must have been that constructed this, and for what reason. It could have on-planet and off-planet applications. We don't know.
We don't know, exactly. Yeah. And because we don't know, we enjoy speculating about it.
Yeah.
But the because what we're looking at is just the skeleton of this civilization. And, you know, how the rest of it looked at the time, we don't know. We can only imagine. And the only thing that we have to work on is what we have experienced and witnessed in history with our civilization and its development and what we have now, you know, compared to what we had years ago. And then we're looking at the Great Pyramid, and that would still be a challenge even for our civilization.
Indeed, indeed. All right, we'll come right back, load those pictures up, and Chris and I are going to take you on a little tour there, and we'll all learn something new, several things new. I'm amazed at the pictures already. Hold on, we'll be right back with Christopher Dunn. His book is The Giza Power Plant. We shall continue. Okay, and we are back with Chris Dunn, and we're ready to go on a little walk through history with Chris. I hope you have those pictures loaded up right under his name and guests, and let's go, Chris.
All right. I wanted to address the subject of the stone at Abu Ruwash, which is a site that is about 5 miles away from Giza, and it's a pyramid. But the pyramid was never completed. Some people say that it was completed, but it was destroyed. But when I went to visit there in 2006 and walked around the site, I saw that there were like a field of stones. If you look in the first picture that has a caption underneath it, view from the top of Abu Ruwash Pyramid, you'll see in the distance, a short distance, a field of stones. Most of those stones are uncut, just rough quarried.
Uh-huh.
Granite and limestone.
Now, which picture is this?
This is the first picture on the page.
All right, and so we've got a blow up of one of the stones laying down there.
Right,
and so when
I visited there in 2006, I was curious because, you know, one of my friends, Stephen Mailer, talked about the Abu Ruwash Pyramid, and he thought that it was a worthwhile visit. So I went there in February of 2006, the first time I visited, I was with David Childress, and mm-hmm. He was doing some video at Giza and around Egypt at the time, And so he accompanied me to the site, and I was climbed to the top of the pyramid. And as I looked down in the base, in one of the courtyards, there was this what appeared to be a precise looking cut stone.
Uh-huh.
And you can see it, and you know, down in the base of the pyramid, and then I've got a magnified image. Of it.
Chris, may I ask a question before we continue?
Sure.
When I look down at this picture,
yep,
I see very unusual formations that appear to be walls or structural footings or bases to the right and upwards from the stone that's laying down there, and off to the left as well. Are those newer walls or are they older constructs? What are they?
Well, they appear to be, well, some of them are new. And they're just made out of mud brick and plaster.
Okay.
Okay. Right. Those are the ones that look like the brown ones that look like they're fairly clean,
uh-huh,
clean looking. Yeah. Then you have the cobblestone wall, so to speak.
Uh huh.
None of that construction is contemporary with the building of the pyramid.
Very good. All right. Thank you.
And
I just wanted to clear that up.
The stone that we're examining in the forecourt there.
Okay. All right. So look at that stone, friends. Right. That finished block of granite just laying out there by itself. Go ahead, Chris.
Right. And then if you look up to the right, there is a scar. It appears to be a scar in the bedrock, and it's really a long trench, and that comes into play later.
Okay.
So, very curious and interested in the nature of this particular piece of granite, because it was really the only piece of granite that I saw on site that had the appearance of being finished or precise. And so, I carry with me, when I go to Egypt, a very precision straight edge and a square, toolmaker's solid square. And these are generally, I can just, you know, briefly look at an object and see if the surface is flat. And I found many very precise flat surfaces.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was assuming from what I was looking at that this may be one of them. But I found something entirely different. And if you go down to the second photograph, you'll see that it's not a flat surface, it's curved.
It certainly is.
Okay, so that was a mystery. Why is it curved? And
very gentle curve.
Yeah, it's not just a curve in one axis, though. It's a compound curve because it's curved in two axes. So if you go down to the image below that, the one with the caption below it that says photographing and measuring the stone, that gives the measurements and the details of the block. And so if you look at A, that's the thickness of the block, and then B is the length of the block, C is the width, and then D, that's another view of the length. But E is a critical photograph because it shows the curve as if you were looking at it along the central axis. If you take that curve and consider it to be a section of a circle, and you're looking down the central axis, and you get that view there. And so that's important. And then on F, that gives you a view of the striations on the surface of the granite, which are not very clear when you're just looking at it. You know, if you're kind of standing upright and looking down on it, you really can't see that. I was using a macro lens on my camera and was able to get some very high-resolution detail photos.
Now, that granite is not indigenous to that area, is it?
That granite is the Aswan granite, and it's quarried about 500 miles away.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and that's another conversation entirely. Talk about, you know, the transportation of massive blocks of granite from Aswan to 500 miles down the Nile.
Those U-Haul trucks were really formidable back then, weren't they?
Yeah. Right.
God. Unbelievable. Look at that. All right, look at the next picture. Chris Dunn.
You know where they got U-Haul from, right? They say, U-Haul it. No, U-Haul it. No, U-Haul it.
Yeah, that's true. All true.
Anyway, so the next photograph, I actually lay a straight edge on the surface, and Dave Childress is with me, and he's looking on. The photograph below that, it's obvious that there's a curve to the stone, and the straight edge is revealing that. There's light passing under it, but the straight edge is like, well, it's only at 12 inches, whereas the width of the stone itself is more like 57 inches.
So I've seen that granite before in people's kitchens, something very similar to that, granite countertops. Yeah. In that style.
Yeah, but you won't get a curve like that.
No, you won't. No, no.
If you go to the following image and you look at the macro image of the surface of the stones, it shows the striations of the saw. And that scale, the scale has 1/16. There are 1/16 divisions on that.
Now, if you look, let me run over this again. The picture with the yellow tape measure.
Right.
And look below at the vertical lines in that granite. Now, Chris, explain what those vertical lines are and what caused them.
Well, those are machine marks. Essentially, as a saw is moved, or a tool, you know, is moved across a piece of material, it will leave serrations or striations on it, and those striations can be worked out, or polished out, or a secondary process that involves lapping or something of that nature can actually remove those and create a very, very highly polished surface. But for actually rough machining of a piece of material, you'll always find the marks of the tool on the piece that you're working, and such is the case here. And that, essentially, what that indicates is that the saw was moving at a particular feed rate.
Yes, you heard Chris right. He's saying saw. S-A. I was just making it clear. You're saying the word saw. It's a
S-A-W.
Circular, a huge circular, or some kind of a saw.
Right. Right.
Not a Bronze Age chisel and a mallet.
No. Okay? No. No. Absolutely not. And so what you have there is the indications of the feed rate of the saw as it cuts through the material. And in this particular case, it shows a feed rate where for each rotation of the saw, it's moving forward about 50 thousandths of an inch, something like that, just less than a 1/16 of an inch.
Wow. Wow.
So we get to the image. Now, because we have a curve, and if we go back to the image, we have a radius along the central axis of, say, a barrel or a saw. You've got the central axis radius, and then if you look at B on the previous photograph, you see there is another radius where the saw broke off the material and the cut was terminated, and there is a clearly defined radius there. Getting back to the one below, the photograph below, the one with the striations of the saw and the scale that we were looking at. This photograph shows the radius of the block along the central axis. I will call that the Z axis, for want of a better term. That would be your Z axis. And so if you look at the chord length, which is A, And the arc height, sometimes called the sagitta, you can calculate what the radius is. And in this case, the radius, looking at this, is around 23.95 feet, which makes a diameter 47.905. So it's almost 48 feet in diameter, but that is what that radius reveals. Now,
so if you, in other words, what you're saying, Chris, excuse me, if you were to draw that radius, that arc, in a full circle, you're saying it would be 47 feet across the diameter of it?
Yep.
Okay. So in other words, take that block, ladies and gentlemen, and just put one after the other after the other at that same arc and make a 360-degree circle, and it would be the diameter across would be 47, 48 feet, thereabouts. In other words, it was designed to be round at one point, it seems.
Well,
maybe.
I don't know. That's a good question, but it's not necessarily...
No, who knows? I got it.
It's not necessarily... The answer may not necessarily be yes. Let's go a little further. And so now we know what the radius is on that surface along the z-axis. Now we look at the x and y-axis from the top and the photograph below it. And that photograph has the caption determining the radius where cutting ended, and the calculations indicate a radius of 23.68 feet, which is 47.3. So a similar radius, a similar diameter. What this indicates is what we have is a compound radius. And if you tilt a saw, there are probably thousands or millions of craftsmen listening to your radio show who understand this, that if you tilt a saw blade and you cut a piece on an angle, then you're actually cutting an ellipse into the material. And you can cut a radius on a piece by tilting a round tool, a circular saw. You can cut a radius that is much larger than the diameter of the saw.
Okay.
And that's a technique. It's actually a technique that tool makers learn when they're, in the trade. And there are actually calculations that you can that are provided that you can make, so that you know what kind of a radius, how to tilt a tool or a cutter so that it provides you with a particular radius. And if you look at the photograph below that, you see that I actually made a model, a 1:61 scale model in my Carter, to demonstrate that particular technique. And essentially what you do is you tilt your cutter, and in this case, it indicated that we had a 45-degree angle to achieve. And so that's basically what we did there. And we tilted the machine head to about a 45-degree angle and then cut the surface, the micarta, so that we had a similar condition. And you can look at the photographs below that photograph of the machine and that strange guy looking at it intensely. And I have time flown since then. But and then if you look at the other images, you can see a photograph of the radius along the z-axis and then the xy-axis.
Very quickly, what kind of would this have been, a blade saw or a large cylindrical surface that was rotating, that was pressed against the granite? What might it have been? What kind of a tool would this have been? Any guesses?
Well, if you take our current technology for cutting, I mean, we do have saw blades, circular saw blades that cut granite.
Uh-huh.
I mean, some of them are very large, around 12 feet in diameter. And they're driven by huge machines.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what you build on a smaller scale for a small job, you expand it to a larger scale for a larger job, and essentially, but you're doing the same. You're involving the same techniques, and you're involving the same materials, and essentially everything's the same. Only it's a lot bigger. It's kind of like if you consider these tunnel boring machines, and we have tunnel boring machines that are 27 feet in diameter, like the tunnel boring machine that dug through the channel, or the English Channel from England to France, and
right.
then you got much larger tunnel boring machines than that.
They dug that channel tunnel, what, 30 years ago?
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, and
it's been a long time.
Imagine what kind of tunnel boring machines they must have now that we don't know about. That's why
that's the thing, you know. I mean, there are means and methods and processes that are in use all over the world today that the layperson has no knowledge of, and so that's why, you know, it's wrong to say that what they were able to do in ancient Egypt, we can't do today. Because if you don't know what's being done today, you really shouldn't make that argument.
And that that plays to the argument and strengthens it that very likely that we are, this country, saturated with long-distance underground tunnels with high-speed maglev or some other kind of technology, transit underground. There's no reason why we wouldn't. We have the technology. We have the boring tools. It's never talked about. So,
people
yeah.
have been transported underground for many, many years.
That's right.
But so when we look at the ancient Egyptians, I mean, and the reason why we're talking about this is that when you consider the discussion and what the narrative has been and how the pyramids were built and how impossible they are, and when you come across a piece of evidence like this, it kind of puts everything into a little different perspective. In that, you know, they were brilliant engineers, and they were they designed and built these mega machines, these pyramids.
Uh-huh.
And why would they limit that genius to just the concept of the product and not apply it in developing tools? And so, and the other argument is, mm-hmm. Jeff, and one that I like to I stress all the time,
uh-huh.
is that it just doesn't make sense that a civilization like the ancient Egyptians that lasted 3,000 years started using copper chisels and stone hammers, and then 3,000 years later are still using copper chisels and stone hammers. You know, it's and then you see the intelligence and the genius behind what they've done, and say, well, you know, they didn't apply that in modernizing their tools and improving their methods. I think they did.
It's very important
to
also. And what I'd like to do, Chris, is invite you to come back Thursday so we can go through the rest of these pictures and wrap this up properly. I don't want to cut this short at all. The rest of the pictures are phenomenal. And we need to do that. If you're available this Thursday, same time, we can do that. So let me know. If not, we'll pick another time. But I want to make sure.
I'll let you know right now. Yes, I'll be happy to do that.
Very good. All right. Thursday will be for all of you out there. We'll have Chris back and continue. But I think it's important when we look at the monuments at Giza not to think that the Egyptians created them. This was some other race of people, some other race of intelligence long ago with phenomenal tooling, phenomenal minds, and phenomenal abilities and vision. And that's what we're looking at here. Extraordinary. Anything you want to add in a final statement tonight, Chris?
No, I mean, I think the it's hard to say who did the work. That it was done, yes. Were the tools found in the ancient Egyptian toolbox? No. So that's where the disconnect is, and that's where the speculation comes in as to how these monuments came to be.
I've always been particularly intrigued by that one glyph, or actually there are a couple of them, showing what looks like a light bulb with a long cable coming out of the back of it, a long cord.
The one at the temple at Dendera.
Yeah. That, I've seen another version of that same concept in another glyph somewhere else. Yeah. I don't remember where. But that is significant for a number of reasons. And we'll talk more about this on Thursday. So we'll pick up right where we are and continue this with you, Chris. Thank you very much. This is absolutely fascinating.
Oh, you're welcome, Jeff. Thank you.
All right. Great to talk to you again, and we'll pick it up on Thursday.
Okay.
Bye. Mr. Christopher Dunn and his book, The Giza Power Plant. Just an amazing amount of brilliant engineering went into constructing these wrecked monuments. Even though they still look rather whole, they were something else when they were built. And we will be right back.